Greetings. Welcome to Media Matters. I'm Bob McChesney, your host, coming to you live today from WILL AM 580 in beautiful Urbana, Illinois. And what a lovely, lovely September Sunday we have here in the heartland. Today we're going to have a terrific show for you on Labor Day weekend. We have as our guest the author of a brand new book, The University in Chains, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex. Our guest, Henry A. Giroux, talking about the state of universities and higher education in the United States today and the striking parallels to what's going on in media. So please join us today for Media Matters. But first, before we go to our guest, let's go to Media Minutes.
Welcome to Media Minutes, a weekly review of news related to media and democracy. I'm Stevie Converse.
And I'm Candace Clement.
The Bush administration has acknowledged that the U.S. telecommunications companies helped the National Security Agency's domestic eavesdropping program. During an interview with the El Paso Times, National Intelligence Director Mike McConnell publicly confirmed the phone company's role in the spying for the first time. AT&T and several other carriers are being sued for permitting wiretapping on international communications and violating privacy rights of U.S. citizens. The government has argued the cases should be thrown out because the subject matter is a state secret and any disclosures would jeopardize national security. McConnell's admission could help get the case into court. Cindy Cohen is the legal director of the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which is heading up the case against AT&T.
I think it will make it very difficult for the government to argue that the case needs to be dismissed at the outset, but it doesn't change the court case in and of itself.
McConnell claimed that reporting on the program or debating the wiretapping bill in Congress would, quote, mean that some Americans are going to die.
Obviously, there are important national security issues that shouldn't be discussed, but this plainly isn't one of them, and to do that kind of scaremongering, it undermines their credibility. I think that an informed citizenry is our best protection against people who try to change fundamentally our way of life.
The Bush administration has urged Congress to pass a law granting more powers to the NSA and immunity to the telecom companies.
Sometimes it's called immunity. Sometimes I think they're starting to present a second option as if it was different, called substitution. Both of these situations would allow the phone company to be off the hook for the last 6 years of violating our privacy, but more importantly, would grant them immunity moving forward. It would mean that the phone companies no longer have any obligation to protect our privacy.
Cohen says that corporate consolidation has helped the administration in their quest for our private information, and the implications for what is becoming our most common method of communication, the internet, couldn't be more important.
You want to have a robust competition for all levels of our communications infrastructure and very strong regulatory limits on what folks can do. But I think it demonstrates the risks that when you get too much of our communications infrastructure in the hands of too few people and no competition, then you begin to see all sorts of areas where things can go terribly wrong, terribly quickly. It's definitely troubling. You have these companies that become a one-stop shop for illegal government surveillance and limits on our access to information.
The Media Management Center at Northwestern University has released a new study about local news in Chicago. The report offers some important insight on how well the TV stations are serving the public. Mike Smith is the executive director of the center.
One reason we think this is relevant nationally is because Chicago is such a good television news town and it's highly competitive. And so we figure if things are under the radar here, we would find them. Among the things we found was a lot of sameness in the content. Only about 45% of a half-hour local program is actually news. It's generic local news. So, you know, when we say that you're all the same, sometimes somebody will quit back. No, no, that's not right. Our anchor wears a red tie and their anchor wears a blue tie. and they think that's differentiation. The format is actually dictating content rather than the news itself.
The report also shows how local news does not represent the rich diversity of Chicago. For every non-white person heard in a story, there are three white people, and news about politics is dominated by people who are white, male, and official.
The whole experience left unexplored in the broadcast world is the one about civic engagement. What can we do in order to make people better informed, feel more positive about their communities, and make them want to participate in things that makes a community civically helpful?
Chicagoans will soon have a chance to air their views on how the local media are doing. The Federal Communications Commission is holding a public hearing on media ownership in Chicago on September 20th.
You've been listening to Media Minutes, a production of Free Press, a national nonpartisan organization working to reform the media. For more information, visit www.freepress.net.
Okie dokie. Welcome back to Media Matters. I'm your host, Bob McChesney, coming to you live today from Campbell Hall on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign on a spectacular early autumn, late summer Sunday afternoon. And thank you for joining us, taking an hour from your day, listening to us wherever you are. If you're on an iPod or somewhere, or off the internet, terrific too. Or if you're just listening locally in your car or at home, thank you again for joining us. We have a wonderful show today. We have two guests, in fact, joining us. The first guest we're going to introduce is one of the most prolific authors in media and cultural studies in the North America today, Henry A. Giroux, author of the brand new book, The University in Chains, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex. Henry A. Giroux holds the Global TV Network Chair in English and Cultural Studies at McMaster University in Hamilton, Ontario, Canada. He also taught for many years to considerable acclaim at Penn State University in education. But as I said, he has done a great deal of writing in media. Much of his work has been in media and cultural studies. Henry Giroux, welcome to Media Matters.
Hi, Bob. Good to hear your voice.
It's great to hear your voice, too. And, you know, I want to know, Henry, you know, you've been writing about media for a long time, about cultural studies for a long time, and now your new book, The University in Chains. Is there a link between your work in media and your current book on universities?
Yeah, I think there is. I mean, I think there's a link in terms of the nature of the crisis that both of these institutions actually face. I mean, I think that if we look at the current right-wing assault on democracy in this country and what I would call an emerging authoritarianism, I think two of the most central sites that are now under attack are basically the media and basically higher education. And I think that both of those sites, in many ways, are very dangerous to right-wing extremists because they recognize very clearly the role that education plays in the possibility of creating a democratic and engaged and critical citizenry. And hence, they see them as sites that need to be addressed, need to be in some way dismantled, and in some way, to say the very least, made dysfunctional.
Henry Giroux, your new book, The University in Chains, basically talks about in the subtitle the military-industrial academic complex. And what do you mean by that?
What I mean by that...
And where does that come from, that term, too, which I think is important?
Bob, it's very interesting because actually the term the military-industrial complex, which, of course, Eisenhower famously coined, what many people don't know is that he actually was going to include academic in the word complex, suggesting that there was an increasingly dangerous correlation between the interest of government agencies, war industries, and the universities. Later, of course, it was framed most specifically by I forget his name, another senator.
Fulbright.
By Fulbright.
Yeah, William Fulbright.
And what I have done in the book is to resurrect that relationship because it seems to me that while there's an enormous debate raging around the corporatization of the university and an enormous debate raging around the attack on academic freedom or the attack on the university's democratic public sphere, I am really surprised at how little is said about the ongoing militarization of the university, the way in which the university has now come under the enormous influence of military Pentagon-funded research, CIA-sponsored academic programs, the growth of military, of the growth of online universities and colleges catering to military personnel, and to put it very differently, the ongoing force of the military and really redefining what the university is all about. I mean, redefining the nature of research, the nature of knowledge, the nature of public solidarity and exchange on the university, now shrouded in secrecy. I mean, so I wanted to highlight those interconnecting forces, and I also wanted to argue that we really have to understand this assault in the university as something much larger than simply the attack on academic freedom.
Before we go to our other guests, I want to repeat, this is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. We're coming to you live today on WILL AM 580. Because of a glitch, our phone lines are not quite up to speed today, so please don't call on our conventional phone lines. We are taking phone calls on another line, and you'll speak with our producer, Andrea Boyle, who will then instant message the question to me, and I'll give it to our guest. And the number you should call if you want to have a question for our guest today is 217-244-2635. Again, do not use our standard lines. They're down. Please call 217-244-2635. Now, joining us, along with Henry Giroux on the phone lines today, is another guest, well-known, I believe, to many of our listeners, John K. Wilson, who is a PhD student in the Department of Educational Administration and Foundations at Illinois State University, and is also the author of four books, including the book that put him on my map, at least, The Myth of Political Correctness, The Conservative Attack on Higher Education, which was published by Duke University Press 12 years ago now, heavens, in 1995, who has also a new book from the same publisher as Henry Giroux's new book, Paradigm Press, Patriotic Correctness, Academic Freedom and Its Enemies. He is also the leader of a group called collegefreedom.org. He started the website they have at collegefreedom.org, which chronicles attacks on academic freedom. John Wilson, welcome to Media Matters.
Glad to be speaking to you.
You've been listening, I know, to what Henry Giroux has been saying, John. And is your book out yet?
No, my book, the Patriotic Correctness book, will be out at the end of the year. And I should note it's part of a series edited by Henry Giroux.
So we've really got the A-team on this subject on the show today with Henry Giroux and John Wilson in the house together. And I know you're familiar with Henry's work, John Wilson. Why did you decide to start collegefreedom.org? What is its purpose? What's the trajectory of your critique?
Well, my aim is to focus on academic freedom and in some ways to look at issues that get neglected in the media coverage about academic freedom, which is framed very much by conservatives saying that the left wing controls academia and they're out to destroy the freedom of conservatives. And what I try and do is do a much broader kind of analysis of looking at all of these different kinds of cases of academic freedom from both the left and the right. And it's very interesting how the right wing will focus on the cases where conservatives are censored, but will not when left-wingers are censored, and even sometimes will celebrate it, most notably in the case of Norman Finkelstein at DePaul University right now.
Well, are there cases, I mean, give some examples, if you would, John Wilson, of examples of conservatives who've been harassed and of not, you know, liberals or leftists who've been harassed or have been subject to some sort of unfair treatment at universities in recent years?
Well, I suppose you could use DePaul University as one example of that, because a couple of years ago, the conservatives were up in arms about the suspension of an adjunct professor there named Thomas Klocek because he had gotten into an argument with some Palestinian students at an activities fair. And that was considered an enormous case among the right-wing media. But, of course, more recently when Norman Finkelstein was denied tenure by DePaul, again, in this case for being rude to his critics, most notably Alan Dershowitz, and on a very kind of similar kind of civility grounds, DePaul denied him tenure, and yet from the right wing, what you see is a celebration of this, and now DePaul has gone even further, and it has suspended essentially Finkelstein and is banning him from teaching or having an office during his final year, which is, of course, normal whenever someone is denied tenure in academia. You receive an additional year to teach while you look for another job. And in this case, DePaul has decided not to allow him to teach.
What happened in the case of the conservative professor? I mean, he was chastised or censored. What was the penalty he got for getting in a yelling match with Palestinian students?
Well, he was suspended, and then he was offered reinstatement, but under the condition that he apologize and that his teaching would be monitored. And so naturally, he did not go along with that. But in his case, really, the example there is of more of the poor treatment of adjuncts, which is another of people who are not on the tenure track, who are the growing number of academics within the whole realm of higher education. And these faculty are very vulnerable. Another example, which doesn't receive nearly as much attention as Thomas Klocek's case, was Douglas Giles, who is a philosophy teacher at Roosevelt University, also in Chicago, an adjunct. And he was teaching a class on world religions where a student asked the question about Israel and Palestine and whether Zionism was racism. And a student complained that this discussion was allowed, even though Douglas Giles himself said nothing wrong. A student complained about this, and the head of Giles' department, after telling him that the Palestinians don't have a side worth hearing and in various ways insulting Palestinians, then fired Giles. And again, an example of someone on the left being censored for this discussion of Israel and Palestinian issues, but really receiving virtually no attention either in the mainstream media or certainly not in the right-wing media, which ostensibly is so concerned about academic freedom.
Our guest today on Media Matters, John K. Wilson, who you've just listened to, who started the collegefreedom.org website, author of four books, including the forthcoming Patriotic Correctness, Academic Freedom and Its Enemies. Also on the lines with us from Hamilton, Ontario, in Canada, Henri A. Giroux, the author of The University in Chains, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex, a book just published, which I've had the privilege to read over the last few days in preparation for the show. Henri Giroux, you've been following universities and their role in society for a long time, writing about it, in addition to your work on media. Do you think that the case of academic freedom, the state of academic freedom in the United States, is worse than it was, say, 20 years ago or 10 years ago? Is there a pattern here in your view, or is this pretty much how it's always been if you've been outside the mainstream?
No, I don't think that it's always. I think it changes in the different historical conditions, and I think that we find ourselves at a time, particularly in the United States, and particularly since 1980, when a confluence of forces have come together around the issues of corporatism, around the issues of militarism, around the issues of right-wing evangelicals exercising enormous influence, around the issue of ultra-conservatives all of a sudden being flush with money from corporate, from right-wing foundations, who are exercising a huge amount of influence in putting pressure on what it means to make the university dysfunctional as a democratic public sphere. And I want to be very specific about what I mean by that. I mean, in the past, what we often saw was attacks on academics who were affiliated with particular kinds of views. One would say that, one had communist sympathies or was not sympathetic to really, what we were doing in World War II and so forth and so on. But the nature of the attack today is very different. I mean, it not only is more pervasive and more powerful in that it's often being mobilized by non-governmental forces with huge amounts of money and have enormous control over both the media and other public spheres, but it also reaches into the classroom. I mean, it's doing something we've never seen before. There's an attempt to actually control and render dysfunctional the very authority and power of the professoriate in general. I mean, we can go from Ann Neal at ACTA to Lynn Cheney to others who are very concerned about not just simply labeling people as unpatriotic, but claiming that the very nature of the university itself now needs to be regulated. It needs to be legislated, that we need to de-skill, of course, professors. We need to take away their power to construct curriculum. We need in many ways to regulate how people get hired. And if you listen to David Horowitz, of course, you know, that would be around a political litmus test. We need, in many ways, to generate laws to prevent conservative students from hearing anything that they don't really agree with, so that they can now complain to the university. Some states are in the process of passing laws that will fine professors who, for instance, don't present what they call a measure of academic balance in the classroom. So I think, A, we have three things going on. One, I think there is a real crisis of legitimate, a political crisis and a legitimacy crisis in the university, unlike anything we have ever seen before. The university can no longer simply make a claim to a kind of autonomy that it did in the past, and politically it's now being assaulted by a range of forces that are more powerful and have come together in a way unlike anything we've ever seen. Secondly, it seems to me that the professoriate, the academics in general, are under assault in a way that goes right to the heart of what it means to be, it seems to me, a critical intellectual, to be able to speak, to be able to develop curricula, to be able to make choices about how we organize our classrooms. You take this power away, and it becomes clear that the university now simply becomes an adjunct of the most undemocratic forces. But thirdly, and this is something that we don't hear much about, is the assault being waged on students. I mean, increasingly, not only do we infantilize students by suggesting that if they hear something in a classroom that they don't agree with, that constitutes the grounds for some kind of complaint, you know, which is outrageous, but we also see an ongoing attempt to privatize, commercialize, and militarize knowledge in ways that have terrible effects for students. A, for instance, we see that more and more grants are being cut. So low-income students are being cut out of the university. Tuitions are rising. We find that increasingly students are often in a position where they find themselves at the mercy of a casualized labor force. Adjuncts who are overworked, underpaid, have no power, and hence in some ways are cheated out of the very nature of the education that they should be getting. So I think that when you look at all of these forces and the way they have come together, particularly under the Bush administration, and what can be, you know, to use a metaphor from the weatherman, an almost perfect storm, I would say that, yes, this is far worse than anything we have seen in the past.
My name's Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters, coming to you live today on WILL AM 580 from beautiful Urbana, Illinois. Our phone lines are not working, as I told you earlier. I know there are a lot of people out there who would love to get on the line with our two guests and talk about the state of higher education in the United States today. But we do have a phone line where you can call and talk to our producer, Andrew Boyle, and he will instant message me the question, and we'll get it on over the air. So if you do want to ask a question to either John K. Wilson or Henry Giroux, the number here at WILL today, only for today's show, is 217-244-2635. John Wilson, following up on what Henry Giroux was talking about, which was, you know, thank you, Henry, for that really quasi-lecture there.
I didn't mean to go on so long.
That was quite good. That's why we have public radio. No, you don't have to cut you off for commercials. And but John Wilson, he mentioned David Horowitz is a name that's come up before on this program. And maybe you could, I know you've probably dealt with Horowitz in the past and in the present, talk a little bit about who David Horowitz is, where he comes from, what his critique is, what he's doing, and how you assess it.
Well, David Horowitz was a 60s radical, former editor of Ramparts, who, in essence, turned against the left and became a radical right-winger during the 1980s. He wrote a book called Destructive Generation, Peter Collier, and as well as books about his past. And he created what is now called the David Horowitz Freedom Center, which he runs and pays himself about $350,000 to $400,000 a year to basically attack the left, and that comes in forms, various forms, from his website, frontpagemagazine.com, as well as a whole lot of advocacy that he does. And one of those is trying to promote the Academic Bill of Rights, which was his effort to get legislators to pass rules pressuring colleges to rein in political faculty, particularly leftist faculty. And Horowitz really has quite a radical idea for removing politics from the university. He's a very political person on the right and very much involved in Republican politics. But He's someone who obviously sees universities as the one last place where leftist dissent is still permitted in a major institution, and he wants to remove ban politics from universities, even going so far as saying that professors should not be allowed to put political cartoons on their office doors, and that professors should not be allowed to discuss the war in Iraq in their classes.
Now, can I, before you go further, I mean, I think a lot of listeners are probably saying, well, isn't it true that most college professors are liberals or leftists, and isn't that a problem if a student's only exposed to one side of the story?
Well, it can be a problem. There's actually a pretty wide range of views that get heard on college campuses, and just because a professor is a liberal or a conservative doesn't mean that they're preventing other ideas from being heard. If anything, I think a really big danger in academia today is that is not the liberal professors, it's the professors who aren't interested in teaching about ideas at all, who are kind of pre-professional business faculty, basically teaching students to go into their jobs in the future and not teaching them to engage in ideas. And so I don't see this threat of left-wing professors that are silencing right-wing students. In fact, there's a lot of liberal professors who are very open to providing students with dissenting ideas and listening quite fairly to what dissenting students have to say. So the issue, though, really is with Horowitz's proposals to solve this solution, the idea of trying to get pressure faculty to hire more conservatives and to silence left-wing professors. That I think is the biggest danger that he presents.
Now, I know you've written a lot about this, Henry Giroux, in your new book, The University in Chains. Horowitz is a figure in the book. What is your take on Horowitz? And when you answer, let me ask, is Horowitz ever, I mean, is part of his critique that in some departments, like business schools and economics departments, that they should be offering a socialist perspective since they generally don't presently?
What was the last question?
Is Horowitz also arguing that there should be more left-wing presence in those departments that are primarily conservative or mainstream?
Horowitz has no interest whatsoever in having the left being represented on campuses or in balance or anything else. I mean, I think that what needs to be said here, and I think John is one of those people in the country who is saying it as brilliantly as anybody possibly can. I mean, I think that what he's simply done is he's appropriated the language of the left of the 1960s and used it to actually promote a kind of anti-politics, a politics in which questions of judgment, thoughtfulness, critical engagement, critical consciousness, you know, engaging a wide variety of historical, political, and social texts is completely at odds with anything that he represents. So I think that, you know, to talk about Horowitz in terms of academic freedom or the principles of fair pedagogy, I mean, all of this is just simply a ruse. I mean, all you have to do is look at what he does. I mean, look at the people he associates with. Look at the attacks that he wages. I mean, this is a guy who says that John Kerry is a communist. I mean, you know, this is a guy who claims that Oprah Winfrey is on the left. This is a guy who appears on Pat Robertson's show and agrees with him when Pat Robertson says that...
Robertson,
yes. Who says that something like, you know, there are 100,000 leftists in the United States and they all do the work of the devil. So it's difficult to take him seriously at the level of actual intellectual argument and scholarly engagement. The real question here becomes, what is he symptomatic of? Who funds him? What are the larger forces at play that give him legitimacy? What's really at stake here beyond whether he's smart or incoherent? And I think the political question is really the issue. I mean, look, the university, these are people who basically view critical education and democracy as an unbearable burden to be contained. They're not unlike the memos that were much more sophisticated that came out of the 1950s and the 60s, the Powell memo, you know, the Institute for... whole range of movements that began in the 50s and the 60s that attempted in some way to recognize that the university had to be contained along with the media, that the question of education mattered, and that there was something in the country called an excess of democracy, and it had to be addressed. And it had to be addressed intellectually, and it had to be addressed politically. And I think it's in the history of that tradition that we have to situate him.
Our guest today, Henry Giroux, who you've just been listening to, John Wilson, is also on the phone lines. Henry Giroux, author of the brand new book, The University in Chains, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex. John K. Wilson, founder of the website collegefreedom.org that monitors threats to academic freedom, the author of the forthcoming book, Patriotic Correctness, Academic Freedom and Its Enemies, coming out later this year, we hope. Now, as I said earlier, our phone lines are down today, but we do have phone lines. You can call and speak to our producer, Andrew Boyle, at 217-244-2635, and he will then transmit through instant message the phone calls, your question to me, and then I will give it, of course, to our guest. You know, Henry, in your book, Henry Giroux, you talk about a multiplicity of threats to academic freedom and to the state of the university, in addition to explicit political challenges to professors of the Horowitz style. Also, you talk about militarism and the CIA, and that's a big chunk of your book. And why don't you elaborate on that, if you would, for a second?
Well, I think that one of the things that I was trying to point out there was that, you know, look, since 9/11, the intelligence agencies are really flush with a lot of money. And they're looking for personnel. I mean, they're looking for people to hire. They're looking for people who can learn languages that are central to what it might mean to, in some way, expand the possibility of their post-Cold War position. And I think that what we now see is we see a lot of this money being translated into research programs. We see a lot of this money being translated into programs that not only sponsor research but also offer scholarships to people who are actually being educated and trained in the universities in ways that would allow them to eventually work for the CIA. Actually, they get funded by the Pat Roberts program. You actually get $25,000 for 2 years, and then you offer them 2.5 years worth of your time once you get hired. I think that a lot of people are very concerned because what we see here, at least in these two areas, is not only the ongoing militarization of knowledge itself. I mean, research not being sponsored for social needs, but research being sponsored for death. I mean, how much money do we really need to put into creating robot armies or insects that carry lethal weapons or can be disguised to carry lethal weapons? I mean, this is an important question. Secondly, there's the issue of what exactly is the purpose of the university with respect to how it educates people? I mean, what role should intellectuals play with respect to the national security state? Do we really want anthropologists? As you know, this debate is waging in the field of anthropology right now. Do we really want anthropologists being educated to provide more sophisticated torture techniques? What exactly are the pressures that are coming to bear on the university that actually produce those kinds of intellectuals?
But, Henry, let me interrupt for a second if I can. You know, as you point out in your book, Senator Pat Roberts, who you just referred to from Kansas, you know, argues that, look, you know, we're in a war on terror. We're, you know, in a world war now. Universities can't sit on the sidelines as neutral players. They have to be part of the team if we're going to win this war, don't they?
Yeah, I think they have to be part of the team and that they have to do everything that they can to prevent those kinds of associations being made between the university and the national security state. I don't think that the university has any place whatsoever in supporting the national security state. I mean, I think that when you look at the long history of what that kind of support has meant, and you look at the long history of the kinds of policies that have been implemented, when you look at the consequences of militarism around the world, as people like Chalmers Johnson and Andrew Bosevich have so amply noted, I don't think that's what the university is. The university is about its autonomy. It's not about serving the warfare state. The university is about questioning and making accountable those powers that would militarize solutions, would look for military solutions to problems rather than political solutions. I mean, I think we need intellectuals who, at the very least, while they can certainly work for the government, should not find themselves in programs in which the very possibility of being able to criticize or oppose those kinds of programs becomes non-existent, given the power that those forces have to really shape the nature of knowledge, research, governance in the university. The university should be autonomous, certainly semi-autonomous. It should not become an adjunct to either the corporations or the national security state. No, I don't believe that should be the case. I mean, you have now, of course, Amy Gutman and the president of Penn State, you know, working in conjunction with the FBI, you know, universities not working in conjunction with the FBI, making the same kinds of arguments. Well, we need to be attentive to what the FBI does. We need to be attentive to what the CIA does. Well, the fact of the matter is the CIA provided all kinds of information about, for instance, the Iraqi war, about the weapons of mass destruction, that was simply ignored because the issue is not about intelligence. It's about politics and who's and how a government works to serve a closed open or closed down democratic relations. And I think that's a far more important question that should govern the role of the university than simply whether it should be in bed with embedded, as they say, with the national security state. I think the confluence of government power and higher education is a very dangerous association, and we need to take it very, very seriously. I'd be more concerned about educating an independent citizenry that is capable of shaping a government in ways that would suggest that war is something that we would resort to in the last resort, rather than making war the emblem of the highest emblem of our national ideals.
My name is Bob McChesney. You're listening to Media Matters. That was our guest, Henry Giroux, author of the new book, The University in Chains, you just heard speaking. Our other guest today, John K. Wilson, who is the author of the forthcoming book, Patriotic Correctness, Academic Freedom and Its Enemies. We just had someone call in with a question sort of related to what we've been talking about, which, and maybe you want to field this one first, John Wilson, asking to address the corporate culture that sort of has taken over the administration of major universities and how the administrative mindset in the past generation has changed dramatically at universities and colleges in America compared to, say, 30, 40, 50, 60 years ago.
Well, I think that's one of the dramatic changes in higher education in recent decades, is that you have a dramatically increasing administrative apparatus over colleges. You have a growing use of kind of corporate management as the model for how you run universities, rather than the idea that faculty and shared governance should have a voice. It should be a more democratic institution. And you have the approach of corporate economic models, of the idea that instead of having tenure-track faculty, people who have secure jobs and academic freedom, you should have adjunct professors who can be fired at a moment's notice as a way to save money and also increase corporate authority over that. And most recently, in the past few days, one example of this kind of growing corporate mentality on campuses at Illinois State University has been a controversy where the marketing department is now requiring all of their students in their classes to wear business casual, imposing a dress code, taking us back decades to the age of where universities would tell their students what to wear. And that's kind of the example that in some ways is more influential than, you know, the traditional cases of corporate influence of businesses sort of buying control over research or over universities with their money. The whole corporate mentality in some ways is a far greater danger than the danger of the individual corporate donation.
And this is a question, a follow-up for both of you. And this is a point that you made, Henry Giroux, in your book, so I'll start with you, in your book on a couple of occasions, which is, you know, you outline this crisis with sort of threats to academic freedom that we've been talking about, with sort of the commercialization of universities and higher education, the sort of shrinking ability to be a critical scholar and get supported in an independent university environment in the United States today. Yet you argue, Henry Giroux, that there still isn't a lot of outrage among professors, among those who are directly affected and who've benefited by the old system and who are in the process of having a much less advantageous position to exercise their work. Why is that? Why aren't professors, you know, taking to the streets and rising up and demanding that this not take place?
I think there are a number of reasons, but I want to give you the most controversial first. And I think that, you know, for many people on the left, particularly in progressives, education has never been seen as, the university has never been seen as a viable site of political struggle. It's always been seen as something that's there. Anything that's political takes place outside of the university. You know, we hand out leaflets in front of factories. We organize garment workers and so forth and so on. Secondly, I think that the very notion of pedagogy as central to a notion of politics, you know, what's the relationship between how we come to know, how our identities are shaped, what kind of investments we make, who we are as subjects and our relationship and how that provides the condition for an active political citizenry is another enormously disregarded area in political, economic, and social theory. I mean, the left is just not interested generally in education as a political force. Thirdly, I think in the hierarchy of knowledges, where you have a certain kind of exchange among what counts, ask yourself how literary theory often fares compared to, let's say, composition and pedagogy. Composition and pedagogy are like a virus in the university. They have almost no academic exchange value, and yet their political currency, the value that they have in making politics central to democratic life, in my estimation, can't be shaped enough. So for me, I'm always concerned about that lack, that incredible absence in political discourse about the importance and the value of education and its relationship to democracy. People like Cornelius Castoriadis, Adorno, John Dewey, I mean, Horace Mann, it goes Paulo Freire, it goes on and on. Outside of the United States, you simply do not find this. But in the United States, it's a problem. And hence, we find that the professoriate in some way doesn't have a language for understanding how to wage those struggles. That's the first issue. Secondly, and I'll stop there. Secondly, I think John can attest to this more than I can, there's a certain powerlessness in the university now. I mean, there's a way in which, as faculty becomes casualized, I mean, you know the figures, 45% of all faculty are part-time, 60% are on non-tenure-track jobs. Couple that with this enormous chilling effect that we see with by using faculty such as Joseph Massad, people like Ward Churchill, people like Norman Finkelstein, endless numbers of people being fired or being not given tenure because they're on the wrong side of the political litmus test, and it creates a chilling effect. I mean, then couple that, the third thing, with the lack of social movements that see education as central to the struggle for any democracy, whether national or international. And you have a set of elements that speak very powerfully to the kind of lack of social and political involvement that education, I think, demands.
John Wilson, I want you to add in on this too, but let me just add another question, a follow-up question, because you've been doing organizing around academic freedom issues tangibly on the ground for the past several years and dealing with professors at all levels. Is there a problem with the fact that a divide-and-conquer, so to speak, strategy with the people who do the teaching at our colleges and universities where, you know, the major research universities, you know, tenured professors actually do have fairly prestigious positions, oftentimes with very high pay, might not see the same threat to them as an adjunct professor does. Their environments are so different, it's difficult for them to find common ground.
Yes, I think that's a lot of it, that the tenured professoriate really is in a privileged position. They don't all the time really understand the conditions under which most faculty in America are working. I think there is also that longstanding fear of professors to get involved with political issues and controversial issues and really challenge what's going on in their campuses and what's going on in the larger world. It's simply a lot easier within the academic system to continue, keep your head down, teach your classes, do your research, and stay out of controversial things. And it's clear in the recent firings of people like Norman Finkelstein, that really is a message to the whole professoriate. If you're going up for tenure, don't do controversial things. And that's a very strong message that's being pushed.
And talk a little bit for a second, if you would, John Wilson, about the state of academic labor. I know this is an issue you're concerned with, and of course Henry Giroux has written about it in his new book. But because I don't think a lot of Americans are not part of the university environment or maybe on larger research university campuses aren't entirely familiar with what's going on, the dramatic shift in university labor, academic labor of the past generation.
Well, what's happened is now a majority of the faculty on college campuses are non-tenure track or they're part-time. They don't have access to this really kind of limited privilege now of the what was traditionally, and in some people's minds, is still a job for life, achieving tenure. It's never really been a job for life. You know, there are a whole lot of professors at Tulane and universities around New Orleans who were fired after Katrina despite having tenure. Ward Churchill is being fired despite having tenure at the University of North, at University of Colorado. And so you have this impression that, that professors are this privileged elite who have a job for life. And really what traditionally professors, all they've had is a fairly low-paying job that, that gave them, after many years of work, a certain amount of protection to speak their minds freely about controversial issues. What you have now is when so much of academia is dominated by people who don't have these kind of protections, who are not able to freely speak their minds and criticize their administrations when they violate professors' rights or students' rights, or who get fired if they're expressing controversial ideas, that, that really undermines what I think used to be a much more powerful kind of critical mass that existed of a more united professoriate who could speak out against these abuses. And instead, what you have are professors who feel more of an allegiance to their departments or to their fields, or rather than the allegiance to the idea of a common profession.
Henry Giroux, in your book, The University in Chains, you refer to a very recent examination of global universities. And in that study, as I recall, 16 of the 20 universities that were considered the best research universities in the world were based in the United States, and something like 40 of the top 50 research universities in the world are based in the United States. The United States has, at present, and for a long time, I believe, you know, a commanding, overwhelming dominance of research universities in the world. Do you think this is going to change? Let me put it another way, maybe a better way to put it, Henry. Where do you think American universities are going to be in 20 years, 10 or 20 years' time, if we don't, on the current path, unless changes are made?
I mean, I think that what we're going to have, we're going to have a two-tier system, basically. And many people have written about this, as you well know, including yourself. I mean, I think that the elite schools are really not going to change all that much. They're flush with money. They can get any student that they basically want. They're not worried about their students being critically engaged because they have to be. But I think the state schools, and I think that the community colleges, I think the schools that underneath the third-tier schools, I mean, all of these universities are increasingly going to be depoliticized and instrumentalized. And I think if there isn't a check of some sort on what it means to restore the university to the kinds of positions that ideally we've always attributed to them, increasingly what we'll have is a system in which you'll have a distinction between people who are being educated and people who are being trained. And the people who are being trained will essentially be on a kind of assembly line that will see itself move right into the corporations, right into the intelligence agencies, right into the military services, and right into low service sector jobs. This is not good. I mean, I would be willing to argue that to the degree to which higher education, not to mention public education, is threatened in this country, to the degree that it is, if this trend continues, then you will have no possibility whatsoever being able to talk about this country as a democracy, because the very conditions that will make it possible will be eliminated. And so it's a very serious threat, and I think we need to take it enormously enormously attentive to this.
John Wilson, you've been organizing on these issues. Are you optimistic that there are steps people who share your concerns can take to reverse the situation? What's being done? What can be done? How hopeful are you?
Well, I think I'm a little more optimistic than Henry. It would hard to be less optimistic. I think that there are a lot of potential ways of people to resist what's going on, things like unionization of faculty or faculty joining the AAUP and other groups to unite together to protect these kinds of freedoms and to bring universities to what they ought to be, which is areas of critical dissent and debate. I think one of the great dangers that's looming before us is the rise of the corporate online university, the for-profit university that basically hands out a degree to students without having them go to the trouble of attending any classes. And that, I think, is going to be growing nationally, internationally, and lots of universities, including the University of Illinois, are trying to jump onto that bandwagon because they see the opportunity to make a lot of money without having to have any of these tenured professors who are so expensive and inconvenient.
Now, what sort of this? How prevalent are the?
Can I mention one thing?
Sure.
I just want to make one qualification. I'm not. My analysis was not to suggest that I'm pessimistic, or to suggest in any fundamental way that the question of struggle shouldn't be ongoing, is necessary, and so forth and so on. My concern is that if we don't, in some way, have some understanding of what the potential is for these anti-democratic forces and how they're working in the United States and the role that education plays as part of that assault, we're in trouble. So the issue is not to suggest that because of that analysis I'm pessimistic. The issue is to suggest, look, if we're going to do anything that matters, we need to be aware of what the nature of the forces are that we're facing.
That's a very good point. Thanks for clarifying that, Henry Giroux. Now, John Wilson, going back to this question you were just raising of universities, distance learning, internet-based universities, and privatization of universities, how prevalent are privatized electronic for-profit universities, electronic or non-electronic? I guess they're largely electronic. How quickly are they growing? And what sort of universities are they? I mean, are they competing in English and stuff, or are they purely trade schools, basically?
Well, the largest growing segment of higher education is the for-profit segment. Places like the University of Phoenix, which combines both online studies as well as having physical universities. And what they offer really is much more kind of job training kinds of things, of giving people business degrees and that. But in some ways, they exist for a lot of reasons. One of the reasons, though, is because of the failures of conventional universities to reach out and educate a wider range of people and to provide this kind of information to the larger public. And in some ways, they're fulfilling a need, a desire for higher education that a lot of the public universities and nonprofit universities, who are much more concerned with being prestigious and making money, they sort of leave open this market that, with the help of student loan money, easily gets filled by these corporate universities.
Okay, Henry Giroux, our guest also today, is the author of the new book, The University in Chains. You've just been listening to John Wilson speak. He's the author of the forthcoming book, Patriotic Correctness, Academic Freedom, and Its Enemies. We've only got a few minutes left. And as I mentioned earlier, our phone lines are down today. But if you do want to call in and leave a message with our – or not talk to our producer, Andrew Boyle, he will get the message to me by instant message. The number here to call Andrew if you want to call in the next few minutes, 217-244-2635. We did have a caller a few minutes ago, Henry Giroux, who called in and mentioned David Brock's Republican Noise Machine and asked, you know, the similarity between the right-wing critique of media and how this applies to the right-wing critique of universities. I think you've talked about that a little bit. And you've also mentioned the Lewis Powell memo. I think a lot of our listeners might not be familiar with this memo. Could you talk a little bit about it, since you write about it in the University in Chains?
Yeah, yes, yes. What I do in that book is I point out that Lewis Powell, I can't remember the exact date. I believe it was in the 1960s.
1971.
1971 developed a broad-based strategy to not only what he called counter dissent, but to develop a material and ideological infrastructure with the capabilities, as he put it, to saturate the American public with a conservative pedagogy designed to, as he said, reproduce the values and the power relations and social relations of the corporate state. And he saw the assault on colleges and universities as one in which the right was not simply to counter dissent or destroy it, but actually to bypass it in ways to allow those universities to be able to produce the kinds of conservative intellectuals that then could shape policy and so forth and so on. So what he did was he urged conservatives to use the language of academic freedom and the call for academic balance to actually increase and to educate and to train a cadre of conservative intellectuals who would then play a very prominent role pedagogically and educationally, not just, of course, at the universities, but, of course, in think tanks and corporations and the media. And in many ways, he became an inspiration for the emergence of many of these kind of private foundations that we're well aware of today, and got enormous funding from the Scaffi family and a range of others. And this actually begins, in my estimation, the emergence of the right-wing re-education machine.
John,
so it's a very important moment in American history.
John Wilson, you deal with threats to academic freedom to the left and the right. I mean, do you think there have been conservatives who have been unfairly harassed who work on college campuses, first of all? And secondly, do you find that there are conservatives who are concerned about the attack on the left? I mean, who think that this is an area of concern? They're not, you know, in favor of that.
Well, I think there are certainly conservative victims of attacks on their academic freedom. I mean, you have to realize higher education is a huge entity with 17 million students, 1.2 million faculty, 4,500 institutions across the country. It's very easy to pull out an anecdote about almost anything to prove your point. It becomes much harder to determine what that is. And I think in some ways the left is partly to blame for failing to come to the defense of conservatives. And it's primarily conservative groups like the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education, which have taken the lead away from the AUP and some other groups dealing with issues of individual rights and free expression on college campuses. And in some ways, they've twisted that debate. But what I think that the left needs to do is to come out and speak on principle and come out for academic freedom for everybody, and with the understanding that where there is a free university, where it's open to debate for all, that there's going to be a place for dissent to prevail. And that's especially what the United States needs, whether it's, you know, a Republican or a Democrat in power. We all benefit from having free universities.
And going to the last point I raised, I mean, is David Horowitz representative of conservatives in the United States, the attitude towards universities where they need to monitor classes to make sure conservative point of views are presented to all students? Or are there conservatives who are opposed to what the Horowitz is suggesting and actually stand with you?
Well, I think there's a lot of conservatives who are very skeptical of Horowitz, particularly libertarians, but some others. However, I think there's a lot more that are starting to jump on the bandwagon and to say that they just despise higher education and want to jump on board. And I think the approach that progressives need to do within academia is to try and divide that kind of right-wing attack and to say, to stand on principle and to bring conservatives and liberals together towards the idea of a free university. And many ways it's similar. I should mention Paradigm Publishers, which is publishing The University in Chains and Patriotic Correctness, is also publishing another book of mine next month called Barack Obama, This Improbable Quest. And that's a book dealing with Obama, who I think is taking a similar aim of trying to bring a united front to promote progressive values. And I think within academia, progressives and can find a way to unite people to have a free university.
You know, I hear the band tuning up in the background, gentlemen, which means we're going to have to clear out of the studio pretty soon to let the next show in here. But before I do want to quickly ask you, Henry Giroux, in a few words, what would you tell people to do who read your book, The University in Chains, and want to get active? How should they get active on this issue?
I think the real issue, as important as academic freedom is, and John is absolutely right, the real issue is that you can't have a democracy without a viable mode of higher education, one that promotes a culture of questioning, one that educates students to be critical, one that educates students to be self-reflective, and one that educates students to link the question of knowledge to the question of social responsibility.
On that note, I'm afraid, Henry Giroux, I've got to cut you off. I want to thank you so much for joining us today. Henry Giroux is the author of The University in Chains, Confronting the Military-Industrial Academic Complex. I also want to thank John Wilson for joining us on the line, founder of collegefreedom.org, a frequent guest here on Media Matters, and author of the new book, Patriotic Correctness. My name's Bob McChesney. You've been listening to Media Matters, and I want to thank my producer, Andrew Boyle. Back in 1 week with FCC Commissioner Michael Kopp. See you then.